Cypher Day. I still owe you a little bit of what I don't like about UMAC, which I've decided to merge with a slightly extended discussion of the influence of CPUs, in particular the influence of video games upon the design of cryptographic functions. Let me phrase this as a discussion of processor-specific message authentication codes. With a question mark, the distinction here that I'm implicitly drawing is between processor-specific software, which of course you want to do. Your software in the end, of course, depends on the processor, even if only through a compiler compiling it for that processor. But here I'm talking about processor-specific message authentication codes, where the message authentication code is the function that gives you an authenticator on a message, given your secrets like RNS, and even the message M computes the authenticator. A processor-specific function means you choose your function depending on the processor to try to make it faster on one particular processor without worrying about others, maybe even punishing some others. Let me start back 10 years ago in the dark ages, 1995, when the Pentium was very new. One of the improvements that Intel introduced for it was MMX. The Pentium MMX was an improvement over the Pentium 1, and the Pentium Pro was improved by the addition of MMX into the Pentium 2. What is MMX? Well, MMX stands for Matrix Math Extensions. At some point, Intel decided they wanted to sue AMD for using the MMX words. And so they first, for about a year, started saying officially that MMX does not stand for anything. It's just a cool-sounding Intel name. And then they sued AMD saying, hey, you're using our cool name. In fact, well, AMD pulled out a bunch of Intel advertising that said MMX stands for Matrix Math Extension. So I don't think you can find this anymore on the Intel website, but that's what it means. What is MMX? Well, it's a set of instructions for the processor, and not just instructions the processor understands, but instructions that it follows pretty quickly. These are quite a few new instructions, several, well, maybe something like 20, I don't remember exactly. There's only a few that are important for speed. And Intel's hope, Intel's design goal, whether they achieved it is a different question, their design goal of introducing these new instructions was to speed up video games. Designed to speed up audio, video, and other simulations of real-world physics. For example, let's look at one of the instructions, which has the very illuminating name of P add W. This name brought to you by the same people who think that %EAX is a good name for a register. P add W is the following operation. It takes 64-bit inputs, one of which is ABCD. A, B, C, and D are 16-bit quantities, and then the other 64-bit input is EFGH. Starting from those two 64-bit inputs, the output is four independent sums mod 2 to the 16. A plus E mod 2 to the 16, and B plus F mod 2 to the 16. And same thing for C plus G and D plus H. Four 16-bit additions in parallel, which is kind of like adding 64-bit numbers, but you stop the carry after every 16 bits. You don't carry from the 16th bit into the 17th bit, from the 32nd into the 33rd, and so on. Another example of a potentially useful MMX instruction is PM add WD, which has nothing to do with Western Digital. This produces from two inputs, ABCD and EFGH, produces the sum, first of all, of, let's see if I get this right, I think it is A times E plus B times F, and maybe I should emphasize this is the result of the PM add WD starting from ABCD and EFGH. It produces AE plus BF, comma, CG plus DH. What kind of operations are happening here mathematically? Are there some mods? Well, and why are there only two numbers here? Well, first of all, this is viewing A, B, C, D, and so on as integers in the range minus 2 to the 15 up through 2 to the 15 minus 1. So A, B, C, D, instead of being between 0 and 2 to the 16 minus 1, as they were a moment ago, are signed integers. And then those numbers are multiplied as integers, producing a result up to 2 to the 30, and then added to another one, producing a result up to 2 to the 31. And that signed number is stuck mod 2 to the 32 into the first half of one of these 64-bit registers, and then another couple of products and sums happen in the other half of this output at the same time. All right, so there's some TM add WD that, based on years of study, Intel thought would be useful for people writing video games and audio processing and so on. Now, if you look at this from a cryptographic perspective, then you should be saying, ooh, multiplications, in fact, lots of multiplications happening at once. If this is a reasonably fast operation, maybe it's useful for cryptography. And I have a couple of different ways that you could try to exploit this for cryptography. You could, first of all, say, well, we could try to break integer operations into these little 16-bit operations. If you want to multiply big integers, then you can try decomposing those big integer multiplications and additions, of course, but multiplications are the big important operation, multiplications, into and the next instructions. Let me emphasize that the mod 2 to the 16, just like the mod 2 to the 64 or mod 2 to the 32 that you're used to for, say, UltraSpark integer operations or mod 2 to the 64, that means you have to keep your numbers below 2 to the 64 to avoid having any accidental subtractions of 2 to the 64 that you would otherwise have to think about. And similarly, when you multiply, when we've multiplied in floating point, we try to keep the product smaller than the range of possible outputs. In this case, we have 30-bit, 31-bit, plus or minus 30-bit outputs, and want to make sure that C times G plus D times H fits inside that without any squeezing. I guess in this case, the mod 2 to the 16 is the main obstacle to having exact integer results. The multiplications and additions in PM add WD are exact, assuming that A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H fit in the right range. So watch out for the 2 to the 16. Keep the radix, your choice of 2 to the 7, say. You might have 7 bits in A, B, C, D. That's unnecessarily small. Let's say 14 bits in A, B, C, D. And then when you add them, you're still not having any trouble with mod 2 to the 16. And when you multiply results, then you fit inside the PM add WD output. You have to make sure that there's some extra bits that are 0. Keep your radix small, so that the mod 2 to the 16 has no effect. And subject to deciding based on that how many pieces you need of your big integers, say 130-bit integers, you might split into 10 13-bit pieces and then multiply those 13-bit pieces with these instructions and add them with these instructions. Subject to deciding how small the pieces have to be, you can certainly break your big integer operations into these little operations. And maybe, depending how fast MMX is, maybe this is a good idea compared to, say, floating point or using the other multiplication instructions available if MMX is fast, which depends very much on exactly which processor you're looking at. But the general principle is you can take your big integer operations and break them into whatever types of multiplication and addition you're presented with. Another way to view these instructions, the interesting alternative view of what the processor provides for us, was introduced by the Black et al. Team in 1999. UMAC MMX says, hey, there's an instruction that the processor does hopefully pretty quickly. By observation, it's not painfully slow. Let's just use it. Let's not worry about the big integers. Scrap the big integers. Throw them away. And instead, define a function that directly uses the operations we're provided. Define a UMAC MMX which uses exactly 16-bit inputs, 16-bit chunks, mod 2 to the 16, and the multiplication instruction, just to compose the addition and multiplication there in exactly the way they're presented, including these mods, and then put them together into something that looks kind of like a message authentication code that you're used to. Now, this has some interesting features, interesting advantages, and also some interesting disadvantages. And as usual, when I have a list, I'm worried about missing something from the list. Let me start with the positive features of UMAC MMX. First of all, despite the mod 2 to the 16, it's kind of like the mod 2 to the 128 that got tossed into Poly 1305 at some point. That mod doesn't hurt your security proof. Maybe it loses a bit or two of security, but you can prove that UMAC MMX is secure. And furthermore, because it's defined in a very easy way using the MMX instructions, you don't have to think at all in order to use your MMX instructions to compute UMAC MMX. You can very easily compute UMAC MMX using the MMX instructions by design. This is how the design of UMAC MMX happened in the first place was, hey, let's put some MMX instructions together in a way that from the formulas looks very much like what you're used to from Gilbert McWilliams Sloan with Winograd's dot product trick that I threw into the discussion end of last time. The problem with this, well, it doesn't end up actually being very fast. So the first bad part of this is that MMX isn't actually very fast. When you look at the details of how fast MMX operations are compared to other operations, you realize actually internally in the Pentium, the MMX operations use the floating point multiplier. They use exactly the same multiplier, but sticking in a bunch of zeros and extracting all of the AE plus BF and so on out of the output. And, well, it's just not getting as much work done as if you tried using the entire floating point multiplier with bigger chunks. You can, of course, say, all right, MMX is not very fast, but we could implement the same function in a different way. You can instead compute the same function, compute UMAC MMX, which I should maybe emphasize again. There's several functions called UMAC, and my criticism of UMAC MMX here from a speed perspective is not something that applies to the other versions of UMAC, which I'll get to in a moment. You can compute UMAC MMX, exactly the same function, using another multiplier you have available, for example, the floating point multiplier and the floating point adder. But when you do this, you start seeing exactly why UMAC MMX is not particularly fast. The multiplications you're doing of 15-bit numbers, 15 bits times 15 bits, wastes most of the floating point multiplier, most of the floating point power. Now, MMX is maybe not quite as bad as you might think, that they really tried to streamline all the operations, and MMX avoids having to spend any time thinking about things like carries, so it's not so painfully slow. It's not as if UMAC MMX is say, 4 times slower than you might initially expect compared to using floating point, but it's still not competitive with the state of the art. On the other hand, it's an interesting idea, and it's an idea that keeps coming back, and the next occurrence of it was with the Pentium 4 version of UMAC. Actually, there's many, many, many versions of UMAC, and I'm just giving a couple of illustrative examples. So let me fast forward 5 years here to 2000. I'm sorry? Testing. You can try pointing the microphone in a different direction. Does that make a difference? Okay. So 2000, Intel introduced some more instructions. SSE E2 as part of the Pentium 4. This is, I believe, the original Pentium 4s were introduced with SSE2, and previous Intel chips didn't have SSE2, so whenever exactly the Pentium 4 was introduced, which my notes say was 2000, that was the introduction of SSE2. And one useful SSE2 instruction, it's kind of like MMX, who was designed. SSE is streaming SIMD enabled, where SIMD is single instruction, multiple data, and this was something else designed for, very explicitly designed for people writing video games. The one instruction I want to emphasize is PMULUDQ. SSE2 instructions include PMULUDQ. And what is that? Well, obviously that is doing 32-bit times 32-bit multiplications, giving 64-bit results. Two parallel 32-bit times 32-bit, giving 64-bit multiplications. And PMULUDQ, like the MMX instructions, is not terribly slow. In fact, it's using a different multiplier from the floating point multiplier, although I don't know how to effectively use them in parallel, but it's clear that PMULUDQ is getting, in some ways, better speeds than you could expect from the floating point multiplier, which is not to say that I've managed to set any record using PMULUDQ, but let me say what Black and so on, the UMAC team, thought as soon as they saw these SSE2 instructions. They said, just like before, we were scrapping big integers before and trying to just build something out of these instructions, let's do the same with PMULUDQ. And so they threw away the original UMAC definition and said, all right, let's get rid of the 2 to the 16, which was kind of slowing down UMAC MMX for making all the numbers small, and let's define a UMAC P4, okay, this is not their terminology, they just call everything UMAC, but UMAC P4 is a different function which you could use to cryptographically protect data, and it's also provably secure, and this is using exactly these 32 by 32 operations, UDQ operations, 32 by 32 to 64, and more precisely, starting from A, B, C, and D, the critical operation is taking A plus B mod 2 to the 32, 2 to the 36, 2 to the 32, and in parallel doing another addition, mod 2 to the 32. Actually, I think four of these happen at once using another SSE2 instruction, and then multiplying the results together and adding a bunch of these mod 2 to the 64. Add many products mod 2 to the 64. And then there's some little output pre-processing, output post-processing, I mean. But that's the critical operation, which is looking like some formulas I was writing down last time. Certainly you can prove, despite the mod 2 to the 32s and the mod 2 to the 64, you can prove the security of this type of message authentication function. And so that's the UMAC P4 function. Did I have another comment about the definition? I don't think so. To say what was wrong with UMAC MMX, UMAC MMX has all these mod 2 to the 16s, and it really forces you to work with just 16-bit quantities at one time. If you try to multiply those 16-bit quantities with something other than MMX, you find yourself wasting most of your multiplication capacity. Somehow 16 bits is too small to really exploit floating point. We've seen that floating point products can be up to 53 bits on the UltraSpark, up to 64 bits on the Pentium and so on, and, well, you could multiply 32 or so bits by 32 bits and fit that into 64-bit floating point. If you try to take these 15-bit chunks and put several of them together into a single floating point number, then they're too big to multiply. It just doesn't fit comfortably. You can't decompose a lot of these 16-bit operations efficiently into floating point operations or into the other multipliers that are available. PMULUDQ has the same feeling of, okay, you really want to multiply a couple of 32-bit numbers. And if that's exactly what your CPU provides for you, then fine. It fits comfortably. It's very easy to write UMAC P4 software for the Pentium 4 or any other chip that supports SSE 2. But if you want to use some other option, because FFE2 does not come out to be very fast, then you really have no choice. You have to multiply these 32-bit numbers. You can't decide actually having 16-bit numbers would be better or 25-bit numbers would be better. This really, the design of the function really limits the options available for writing software. Limits the implementer options. You can decompose these 32-bit chunks into small enough pieces to do with floating point multiplications. You can do additions mod 2 to the 64 with floating point operations. You can do anything with floating point operations, but it's not very fast compared to decomposing a big integer operation into floating point operations. You can really decide how big your pieces are for the capacities of your chip's floating point unit. And similarly, whatever other multipliers are available, you can see the conflict even between the two versions of UMAC, that if all your chip provides for you for fast multiplication is UMAC, is MMX, then trying to implement UMAC P4, how do you use these 16-bit instructions to do 32-bit multiplications? You have to break your 32-bit pieces into lots of little pieces, and then the mod 2 to the 32 and mod 2 to the 16 are really annoyingly incompatible. You spend a lot of time dealing with that incompatibility, much more than you would if you started with bigger multiplications that you can decompose in many different ways. And similarly, if you're using a Pentium 4 and trying to run UMAC MMX, then you're wasting most of the multiplication ability that the Pentium 4 has. But okay, that's what they did, and UMAC Pentium 4, at least on the Pentium 4, achieved some reasonable speed. And at this point, I have the wonderful speed table. Let me tell you, for comparison, how fast Poly 1305 is. And there is one point here where, as I've mentioned, UMAC is faster, and that's something at least potentially interesting. At least for that situation, we should pay attention to it. Let's suppose that you have a 1024-byte packet that you're authenticating. Maybe a little small for big internet packets, but there's also smaller internet packets out there. 1024 is some nice intermediate size for message authentication. I'm going to throw in time for stream cipher, the AES counter mode stream cipher, although that's not the state-of-the-art stream cipher that I'll talk about later during stream cipher day. But for these timings, it's included. And I have here a list of five CPUs where timings happened. One was a PowerPC G4. This is old Macintosh Motorola chip. To be precise, there's a couple different G4s. This is a G4 7410. Then there's our teaching tool, the UltraSpark 3. Which is a little better streamlined than the PowerPC. Then next on my list is the Pentium 4. And then the next is the Pentium M. And finally the non-Pentium, the Athlon. Not the Athlon 64, just the old Athlon 1. And on each of these CPUs, what is the cycles per byte for putting together all the ideas for univariate polynomial evaluation and trying to really streamline that? We get Poly 1305, which together with AES takes, on an UltraSpark, I've been quoting numbers like 4.25 cycles per byte. And actually, these timings were done by somebody with the previous software, so it's a little slower than the 4.25, plus there's the time for AES, which happens only once for the 1024-byte message. I'll get more into the stream cipher versus message authentication later, but AES adds a little bit to the effective cycles per byte here, ending up with, where's the number, 5.47 cycles per byte instead of the 4 point something. So 5.47 times 1024 bytes, something like 6,000 cycles on an UltraSpark to authenticate a 1024-byte message. All right, a PowerPC is slower. PowerPC is kind of like the UltraSpark in that it can do every cycle a multiply and an add with 53-bit floating point. But the multiply and add have to be linked. If you're computing A times B plus C times D plus E times F plus etc., then the PowerPC can do plus E times F in one cycle. And it can do plus G times H in one cycle. But the initial A times B has to be on a cycle of its own. It can't be merged with some other addition. The UltraSpark can do an independent addition and multiplication each cycle. The PowerPC has a fused, you can add a product in one cycle, but then your initial products take extra cycles. Plus, the PowerPC has a funny feature that it chugs along doing one floating point instruction every cycle for a cycle, and then it gets tired and has to rest for a cycle. And then, okay, it's ready again, floating point. Well, okay, so it only does one floating point instruction every 1.25 cycles on average, and between those two slowdowns, we end up at something like 8.27 cycles per byte. Then the Pentium 4 is faster than the UltraSpark 3, 5.33 cycles per byte for this computation. The Pentium M is 4.5. I've mentioned that Pentium M can do one floating point operation every cycle, where the multiplications and additions have to be all on separate cycles. There's only one floating point unit instead of the two in the UltraSpark 3, but the floating point operations are bigger here. They're 64 bits instead of 53 bits for the precision of your output, and that makes the Pentium M faster. Pentium 4 actually has essentially the same performance features, but it has more latency and enough sort of extra bottlenecks, like load store latency is much more serious on the Pentium 4 than on the Pentium M. So it's hard to get down to exactly the same number of cycles as the Pentium M. And then the Athlon is the fastest one on my list. It can do a 64-bit precision out of 80-bit floating point multiplication and addition every cycle, and that ends up with the lowest cycle count, 3.75, which could maybe be improved somewhat. A lot of these numbers, well, any number you look at, you should think, okay, can that be improved? And I think the 8 could be improved somewhat, the 3 could be improved somewhat, the 4.5 is probably about optimal. Okay, so that's the Poly 1305 speed, and let's compare that to the UMAC P4 128 AES speed. 128 there for the UMAC output size, where there are many options for UMAC's output size, P4 for this latest version of UMAC that I'm focusing on, AES for the stream cipher. Actually, AES is also used as a block cipher, a general scrambling function inside UMAC, but okay, it's not a big cost inside UMAC. Most of the numbers here are just a little bigger and treat AES as something that slows down this computation without having to worry about what it is. What slowdown does it produce? Well, for the UltraSpark 3, our teaching tool, I'm sure this can be improved, but the UMAC software takes 51 cycles per byte. On the PowerPC, it's 21 cycles per byte. On the Pentium 4, that's where UMAC beats Poly 1305 and takes only 3 cycles per byte. On the Pentium M, it's back up to 8.48, and on the Athlon, it's 7.38. The Athlon does not, well, depending which version of the Athlon, does not support SSE 2. The Pentium M does support SSE 2, but just doesn't make it as fast as the Pentium 4 does compared to the cycle time. And even though UMAC is trying to use the same instructions on the Pentium M, it doesn't end up being nearly as fast. But on the Pentium 4, it does. And so this is, let me highlight that 3.12. If I want the best speeds for cryptography, here's a case where it is possible the UMAC authors did better, significantly better, than Poly 1305 and achieved about half the number of cycles per byte compared to Poly 1305. Now, based on these numbers, you could say that people should authenticate messages using UMAC instead of Poly 1305. And there's maybe a crude version of this argument, which is too extreme, and then a reasonable version of the argument that we should be looking at UMAC P4. So there's, first of all, the crude argument for UMAC P4 if you look at the advertising for UMAC, then you see the following sequence of really stupid arguments followed by some reasonable stuff. They start by saying UMAC takes, I think it's less than one cycle per byte. And what they mean by that is that UMAC produces a 32-bit authenticator, something that you have only a 1 in a billion chance of forging. in less than one cycle per byte. Well, okay, if you scale it up to a reasonable security level, something where you can comfortably say to users it is not going to be, your messages are not going to be forged, then that multiplies the runtime by a corresponding factor of 4. You then look further at their timings, and they say, okay, UMAC takes this number of cycles per byte, where they simply ignore the other processors, and this is the crude argument for UMAC P4, is, well, the Pentium 4 is the dominant processor. Pentium 4 is what everybody has, the dominant CPU. And it's okay to have substantially higher times on other processors to turn the Athlon into half of its speed because very few people have Athlons. Everybody has a Pentium 4. It's okay to punish other CPUs. Now, your reactions to this argument probably depend on what CPUs you actually have. There was a time when Pentium 4s really were dominant and the Athlon was just appearing on the scene and nobody had a Pentium M yet, and it really felt like the Pentium 4 was the wave of the future. Not too many people were predicting that Intel would scrap Pentium 4 development in favor of the Pentium M, Pentium Core line. Now, it seems kind of silly to just do Pentium 4 timings and to focus on the Pentium 4 since everybody's laptop is a Pentium M, or, all right, there's some other possibilities, but certainly there's other CPUs out there, not just the Pentium 4. There is a more sophisticated argument for UMAC, which is the part that I find interesting. I think it's not terribly convincing, but at least it's something you can reasonably say, which is that you can keep the Pentium 4 benefits without having the cost of punishing other processors. You can reduce the cost, reduce the punishing of other CPUs, and keep the benefit by changing which cryptographic function you use depending on your processor. If you have a couple of Pentium 4s communicating, if you have a communications link between sender and receiver where both of them are using Pentium 4 CPUs, which is sometimes the case, fairly frequently the case, then they can use this 3 cycles per byte. They can use UMAC P4. And then all other situations where Pentium 4s are not the bottleneck. You might have something where a busy Pentium 4 server is talking to some client that has lots of time. And in that case, you would again choose UMAC P4. But basically, other situations, if you have two non-Pentium 4s or a Pentium 4 and somebody else who does care about speed, then the total time is minimized by using Poly 1305. So everybody else can choose Poly 1305. And this, at the expense of having a dynamic selection of which cryptographic function you're going to use, this often does give you the 3.12. You could just select the UMAC P4 if you have Pentium 4s on both ends and get the 3 cycles per byte. And then in every other situation, get the speed of Poly 1305 and really not have to worry about how slow UMAC P4 is. There's maybe a little time to talk to the other processor and say, are you a Pentium 4? But that can usually be embedded into your internet protocols with no serious cost. So this really does get the benefit here with some complication and something that doesn't really slow down your protocol. The only thing that doesn't seem to have worked about this argument is that users don't like it. Users don't like hearing that they're going to have different cryptographic standards for different situations. Complexity deters users. Until recently, the UMAC people didn't realize this, and they were just advertising every different UMAC option and saying, UMAC MMX, use that for your MMX computers. And there's a different version of UMAC for some other 16-bit processors, and then there's a signed 32-bit, unsigned 32-bit, blah, 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 blah. They had a ton of options. And Ferguson and Schneier, in their practical cryptography book, started looking at these options and saying, we just can't deal with this complexity. What are we supposed to do with this? We're not going to be writing software that actually tries to take advantage of this. It's too complicated. We're going to throw it all away. Now, current UMAC follows this and throws away the old options and just has UMAC P4 is the current UMAC. And they're just saying, okay, these processors, Pentium 4, its good performance, which if you have Pentium 4s is something reasonable to say, but there's still the complexity of, okay, UMAC has to compete with other functions like Poly 1305. And I can imagine a world where we do get the extra performance of UMAC P4 on a Pentium 4 while obtaining the performance of another cryptographic system on another CPU, but will cryptographic implementers actually use this? Will people actually have machines talking to each other and saying, yes, we are Pentium 4s, please switch to this other UMAC P4? Maybe. It's something that we can try to achieve. I should add one final note here about UMAC. Which is that the factor of 2 speed up here can be entirely accounted for by what I was saying last time about Winograd's dot product trick. Instead of saying, okay, there's this interesting PMOL UDQ and let's try to exploit that for designing a cryptographic function that uses it, let's instead just stick to big integer operations, something comprehensible like multiplication in a big field, big being around 128 or so bits. It should be possible, if you're willing to have the same assumptions as UMAC, and remember my initial reason for excluding UMAC from my discussion was that it has a big R, a big secret, at least after expansion, after stream cipher type processing. If you're willing to have a lot of storage, a lot of memory devoted to each key, multiple kilobytes of data for each key, then you can use Winograd's dot product trick together with floating point. Use the big field F. Don't complicate things by having mod 2 of the 32s running around. Do a more traditional Poly 1305 style design where instead of having powers of R, R, R squared, R cubed, and so on, you have separate independent R's. That's the big secret, that you dot product that with your message. And then, as I indicated end of last time, this should save about a factor of 2. Should save about half of the cycles of the floating point operations, and therefore of the cycles. And while it should turn the 5 or so cycles per byte into 2.5 cycles per byte, being faster than UMAC consistently on every machine. This is not just the P4 speed up. This should speed up every CPU. Which means that the whole question of, hey, look at that 3.12, isn't that excitingly fast? Shouldn't we vary our cryptographic functions depending on which types of processors are communicating? That question disappears if we get one function that's providing consistently fast speed on every CPU. The only reason I'm not doing this is that I don't like the big R. And open question that I said at the end of last time is, can you do something like this for higher degree polynomials, not just linear polynomials in many variables, and still come up with a security proof for your final message authentication code, avoid having multiple messages producing the same polynomial. All right, so I think UMAC is obsolete, but the same question keeps coming up. And I realize that, oops, I was supposed to leave a line at the bottom here for, I guess that's space on the right side. Despite the UMAC approach to message authentication, and focusing on the Pentium 4 in this particular way, despite that being, in the end, apparently a slow way to do message authentication, the same issues show up again and again and again. And the example I wanted to cite was VMAC, which is designed specifically for the Athlon 64. And saying, okay, let's look at the Athlon 64 instructions, the fastest ones it provides, and try to optimize for that. VMAC produces some speeds, which I haven't looked at the Athlon 64 in enough detail to evaluate whether those are the best that somebody could do on the Athlon 64, really putting together all the tricks available. And certainly, they're very small numbers of cycles per byte, but the Athlon 64 achieves that for lots of different computations. So I don't really know at this point how to evaluate those. It's an interesting idea, and maybe that is the best way to achieve speed on the Athlon 64, is to take advantage of the Athlon 64's new instructions. And fast-forwarding from 1995 and 2000 to 2005, we suddenly have 64-bit processors with a new performance picture, and maybe our cryptographic functions should be designed to take advantage of that. All right, which brings me to stream ciphers. Okay, so this is major course topic number 2. Let me pause for just a moment here. Any last questions about message authentication? Yeah. You could talk about lower bounds for the number of cycles per byte if you have in mind a particular flavor of computation. If you said, for instance, you're going to use floating point, and then here's how many cycles your floating point operations take, then you can, assuming that your floating point multiplications are exact, say, well, we need this many bits of output, and we need to handle this many bits of input with the following multiplication structures, blah, 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 and come up with, of all the algorithms you envision, of a pretty broad space of algorithms, which maybe includes everything that people do, you can say all of those will take at least this many cycles per byte, depending on your CPU. Again, there's machine dependence that the floating point capacity, the multiplication capacity of the Athlon is noticeably bigger than the multiplication capacity of the UltraSpark. The Athlon just has bigger multipliers and can use them as quickly as the UltraSpark does with more precision. But subject to those chip differences, you can certainly analyze classes of algorithms and say, here's how fast those algorithms are. What you can't do, at least you can't prove, is that you've come up with the best algorithms. Someone could always imagine a faster algorithm which does message authentication at even higher speeds. For Pauli 1305, I'm comfortable saying that for most performance situations, this is a sufficiently small number of cycles per byte that I'm not too worried about it. I don't feel the need to go for even more speed, aside from it's fun to go for even more speed, and maybe there are some performance extremes where people really need the fastest message authentication, and 4 or 5 cycles per byte is not satisfactory. Depending on what else you're doing, you might only have a tiny fraction of your CPU available for message authentication, or maybe you're optimizing your cryptographic functions for much smaller chips that are just much slower, have much less capacity for doing computations. Depending on what your situation is, whether this is fast enough, well, I don't know. Looking at Google, is this fast enough for Google? I think it is. I think there's other bigger cryptographic bottlenecks for Google than the cost of the secret key message authentication, but it's always possible to look for something better, and as illustrated by Winograd's dot product trick, there can easily be things that suddenly give you a factor of 2 or some other speed up that you weren't anticipating in the design of your computation. So you can certainly, to answer your question, if you look at limited classes of algorithms, yes, you can give lower bounds on cycles per byte, but you should always keep in mind the possibility of other algorithms that speed things up beyond what you were expecting. When I talk about upper bounds versus lower bounds, I'm limiting my classes of algorithms and saying, okay, suppose you have in mind a particular type of computation. Say you're doing the following floating point operations, how many cycles do those take? And then if your software is slower than that, then you should try speeding up the software, removing the other bottlenecks like latency bottlenecks. But I wouldn't say those are lower bounds on the computation time of all algorithms. They're just lower bounds on the computation time of one particular sequence of floating point instructions. More questions about message authentication? Okay, so stream ciphers, what do I have to say? First of all, let me say what stream ciphers do for you. This is major course topic number 2. And now that we know what the UltraSpark is and what some other processors look like, I don't have to spend the time for this topic doing the review of that again, we know what it means to look for the fastest software for something, but the something has now changed. What we're doing is expanding a short shared secret into a long shared secret. Which, of course, does not produce a uniform random secret. Let me specify the input here. The shared secret, the shared key, is going to be called K. And then I'm going to define a particular function called salsa20, which takes as input K. And where is K living? This is a function from 256-bit strings. What is the output of salsa20? It's a long string. Salsa20 of K is a string with a huge number of bits in it, and you can take as many bits as you want. If I left out the N here, then 01 to the 512. This would be taking 256 bits and stretching them into 512 bits, which is enough for R and S1, S2, S3, maybe. But in fact, there's an N here, which is a gigantic number beyond anything that we're actually going to need. And you can take as many bits as you want from the output as R, S1, S2, etc. So expand K, 256-bit string, into salsa20 of K. Before I combine this with message authentication, let me say the standard security conjecture, what we want this function to do for us, how people evaluate functions like this, stream ciphers, and decide, are they secure? Well, we can't prove anything, but what is the conjecture that we're trying to achieve? We're trying to say that the output of salsa20 looks uniform. It's not uniform, but we want it to be indistinguishable from uniform. So here's the standard conjecture, is that if you look at the output, this 512N-bit string, imagine N is a million, 512-million-bit string, if you look at that output, when K is a secret 256-bit string, for a uniform, random secret, you're not given K as an input, but you're given salsa20 of K, where K is a 256-bit string. This 512 million, or whatever length string, is conjecturally indistinguishable from a uniform random string of the same length. Uniform random string U, which is 512N bits long. So to run through the rules of the game again, somebody comes up with a secret key K by flipping 256 coins. They feed that through salsa20, getting billions, whatever number of bits of output. They give you that output, and you're supposed to be able to say, yes, that is a salsa20 output. As opposed to if somebody gave you just a flipped 512 million bits of coins and then gave you those bits instead, then your algorithm's supposed to say, no, that's not salsa20 output. Unless, of course, they got very, very lucky. To be precise, a distinguisher, okay, it doesn't have to reliably say yes or no, but it does have to have some gap between the chance of saying yes for salsa20 and the chance of saying yes for a uniform random string. So here's the definition of a distinguisher. And indistinguishable means there are no distinguishers. A distinguisher is a tolerably fast algorithm A. Actually, I wanted to stick to A for attack, so my distinguishing algorithm will be D, I think I called it. Yeah. Tolerably fast algorithm D that says yes for salsa20 of K. If you feed it salsa20 of K, then it says yes, at least with some pretty big chance. If you look at the probability, and this is over all the choices of K, 2 to the 256 choices of k. Suppose you feed solve to 20 of k as input to D. And it says, yes, 1. That probability, well, for a completely reliable distinguisher, it would say, yes, that is solve to 20. This probability would be 1. But in general, distinguisher just has a good chance, some chance. This probability is noticeably larger than the probability that if you feed in a random string to D, then you get 1. Now, you might object as a mathematician, you might object to this definition saying, okay, what is tolerably fast and what is noticeably larger? And the right answer is these are parameters. You have distinguishers with a given limit on the resources used by your algorithm, like the number of bit operations, say, or the price-performance ratio of your algorithm, and then you have some parameter saying what noticeably larger is, like a 1 in a million chance of recognizing solve to 20 output. Whatever those parameters are, that tells you what your distinguisher is, which then tells you what indistinguishable is, and all of these are made precise in the solve to 20 security conjecture. When I talk about attacks, I'll say a bit more about what the limits are of attacks here, which is not just the most obvious attack that I'll say now. I want to make sure the definition is clear by giving just a very simple example of D, and then I'll say more about attacks on solve to 20 later. Let's consider as an example of this D, as an example of distinguishing, let's take the algorithm D. What does D have as input? It has 512 million, whatever number of bits of input, given a 512n bit string x, compares x to all the possible solves to 20 outputs, one by one, runs through 2 to the 256 possible outputs, says yes, says 1, if x equals solves to 20 of 0, or x equals solves to 20 of 1, or etc., or x equals solves to 20 of the last possible key, solves to 20 of, let's just use integer notation, 2 to the 256 minus 1 is the last key. How many solves to 20 computations are there here? Well, you might hope that this algorithm could be sped up somewhat, but let's just assume for a simplified algorithm that this does 2 to the 256 independent solves to 20 computations, each of which is very fast. So if we weren't doing 2 to the 256 of them, this would be a tolerably fast algorithm, 2 to the 256 independent solves to 20 computations. Is this algorithm a distinguisher? Well, let's evaluate the probabilities and then look at the definition. First of all, the probability that D of solves to 20 of k equals 1 is exactly 1. D of solves to 20 of k, the probability that that equals 1, well, you run D on solves to 20 of whatever, and it runs through all the possibilities for whatever, and eventually runs into, if k was 37, then it tries solves to 20 of 37, and says, aha, that is equal to my input x, so it says yes. And whatever solves to 20 input it has, it says yes. For comparison, the probability, if you set in just a random 512n-bit string, uniform random 512n-bit string into D, then what's the chance it gives you a 1? Sorry, say again? 1 over 2 to the 256. Actually, it's even smaller than that. Yeah, 2 to the 256 divided by 2 to the 512n. It's at most 2 to the 256 out of all of the 2 to the billion or so, 2 to the 512n, actually n's much larger than this, but okay, 2 to the 256 divided by 2 to the billion. This is just a ridiculously tiny number. It's less than or equal to this, however many distinct solves to 20 outputs there are. Conjecturally, solves to 20 is injective, 1 to 1. so this probability is exactly 2 to the 256 over 2 to the 512 n. Certainly it's less than or equal to this. Out of all the 2 to the 512 million possible strings u, only 2 to the 256 of them pass the test computed by this algorithm. So the probability that d of u is 1 is ridiculously small. The probability that d of any salsa 20 output is 1 is 1. And that's certainly a noticeable gap. For any reasonable definition of a noticeably larger, the difference in probabilities here is noticeably large. 1 minus tiny, 1 minus 0, basically. But d is not a distinguisher because it is not tolerably fast. It's taking 2 to the 256 operations. Are there better distinguishers? Well, conjecturally, no. But I want to give you some use of salsa 20 and then some speed ideas about salsa 20, then the definition of salsa 20, and then I'll get back to what people are able to do with attacks on salsa 20. And then variations, and that will take me through the end of today. All right, that's the security conjecture. We certainly can't prove this, but this is how stream ciphers are evaluated, is for their distinguishing probabilities. Now, once you have some function that is conjectured to have this property, then you can say, hey, from a short string, we've produced a long string that seems random, so let's use that for the R and S1 and S2 and T's if we have them for encryption. So here's the using a stream cipher together with poly 1305 to reduce the amount of shared secret data you need, salsa 20, comma, poly 1305. You can substitute whatever authentication function and whatever stream cipher here, and you'll get the same kind of security guarantee I talk about in a moment. What do you do? Well, first of all, through the old channel, the sender and receiver come up with their 256-bit string K. Instead of exchanging R and a bunch of S's and maybe a bunch of T's, the sender and receiver just exchange K. If all they were doing was one R and one S, then that's the same length as K, but for the general picture, they were exchanging much more R and S, and now we're just going to have the sender and receiver share a uniform random 256-bit K. And as in previous secret sharing, they do this through some old channel, through a secret authentic old channel. This substitutes for having shared a ton of data through the old channel. Starting from K, they both compute salsa 20 of K. Salsa 20 is a public function. I'll give you the definition, although not quite yet. Both of them compute salsa 20 and declare that that is R, S1, S2, etc. However much data they want out of it, and is gigantic, they can extract all that data out of salsa 20 of K. Now, this is not a uniform random string of 512 million or whatever number of bits. It's only 2 to the 256 possibilities for the string. But nevertheless, we're going to go ahead and use that string with poly 1305. Authenticate the nth message, which I'll call, say, m sub n. How do you transmit the nth message? You transmit it as n for the message number, and then m sub n, the message. So far, it's just an unauthenticated internet protocol numbering each message so you can recognize messages out of order and dropped messages. Then the authenticator is you take the message m sub n, you evaluate it at r, and you add in s sub n, simplified version just over big field, 2 to the 130 minus 5, and then tweak this for the real world as in poly 1305. All of the generation of the r's and s's is independent, orthogonal to what poly 1305 does with the r's and s's. Similarly, if you want secrecy, here I've just described authentication, but you can combine this with whatever you're doing with your secrets, use the r, s, 1, and so on as those secrets. So similarly, you can provide secrecy if you want. In which case, you declare some of your salsa 20 outputs to be t's, and you add t's to the message m sub n. Now, we think this is secure. We think that the message authenticators there can't be broken, that nobody can forge a message, even though we certainly don't have a proof. This is conjecturally secure by the same notion of security that we have, that we proved for poly 1305 with uniform random Rs. Here we have non-uniform Rs and Ss and so on. But despite the non-uniformity of that data, the poly 1305 input, we conjecture that this is secure. Somebody can't come up with an M prime and an A prime that satisfy the verification equation. It is possible to carry out some types of attacks that weren't available before because of the RS1, S2, and so on being limited by them being a SALSA 20 output. There are new types of attacks. For example, let me give the message authentication equivalent of the brute force attack running through all SALSA 20 outputs that I was saying before, and then compare this to what could be done for original poly 1305. When the attacker is given a whole bunch of authenticators, he can check them for consistency with run through all the possible keys. Run through SALSA 20 of 0, SALSA 20 of 1, etc. And let me emphasize continuing this computation for 2 to the 256, if necessary, 2 to the 256 minus 1. So on average, halfway through, it'll find the right key, K. And then whichever one of these works, presumably only one of them works with, say, three authenticators, that should be enough information to deduce K. In other words, deduce R, S1, etc. Only one of the SALSA 20 outputs is consistent with all the Rs. Now, this is a very, very slow attack. This is not tolerably fast. It takes 2 to the 256 operations, computations. It's a type of attack that we couldn't carry out before. If you did carry out this attack on poly 1305 with uniform random Rs and Ss, imagine that you had this much computation time, you still wouldn't get anywhere. You still wouldn't figure out any information about R. If R, S1, S2, and so on, if the S's are independent, then they're revealing no information about R. In this case, when there's SALSA 20 outputs, they're not independent. The S's do reveal R if you spend enough time doing a computation. And the conjecture here is that if you don't have that much computation time, if you just have a tolerably fast attack algorithm, then that will not be able to figure anything out about R. Well, won't be able to come up with any forged messages. Question? What do we need to do? Sorry? To deduce K. Well, okay, what the algorithm does is it says, I'm going to guess all these possibilities for K. And then looking at SALSA 20 of 37, for instance, that is a sequence RS1, S2, and then try generating the authenticators from those RS1, S2 and see whether that matches what the actual sender did. And if it does, then you figure 37 must be the right key. Assuming some sort of injectivity, this is an attack that conjecturally deduces K, assuming that the SALSA 20s have enough differences in their initial bytes, then maybe I should say, okay, if you look at the first 512 or so bytes of the SALSA 20 output, if you look at R, S1, S2, S3, then that probably determines K. Probably the map from K to those is injective. And almost certainly if you look at R, S1, S2, S3, S4, then that's going to be enough to determine K. But we don't have proofs of this. We just have reasonable conjectures that SALSA 20, if you write down all these different SALSA 20 values and then for each of them take the first, say, 512 bits of the output, RS1, S2, S3, and compare those to the first three authenticators, then, I'm throwing away some information with only three authenticators. Let's say you do 10 S's. It doesn't matter exactly what the number is, as long as it's not too small. Say you write down the first 10 S's, compare them to the first 10 authenticators. Then I believe, everybody believes, that only one choice of the K is going to be consistent with all those authenticators. You run through the authentication computation and say, is this consistent with what I'm seeing from the sender? And if it is, then you assert, based on this belief that only one K works, or checking every possible K and seeing that only one K works, you see that here's the K that the sender must have used. Is that answering your question? Okay. All right, so again, this is a type of attack that before we weren't worried about the possibility of these attacks because they just don't break the protocol. And now we have to take a different attitude that the attack does break the protocol, conjecturally. It does deduce K or something that's as good as K, as good as the legitimate K, well, presumably the right K, the one that the sender and receiver have. But we're not worried about this attack because it's very, very slow. And we conjecture there's no better attacks. Now, I've written down two conjectures, and these are not independent conjectures. These are related conjectures. The reason that people talk about distinguishers is that conjecturing indistinguishability implies all the other conjectures we need. For example, the first conjecture there implies the second. Indistinguishability implies security against forgery. And similarly, if you wrote down a secrecy version of this protocol, then indistinguishability would imply secrecy, protection against eavesdropping. And if you wrote down some more complicated protocol with denial of service and it works with uniform random Rs, then assuming indistinguishability, the SALSA 20 outputs are perfectly fine substitutes for the uniform random sequence of Rs. Even though they're not uniform, we still have a general purpose composability of whatever your security proof is for the protocols using big, long, random shared secrets, uniform random shared secrets, that can be composed with this general substitution of SALSA 20 for a uniform random sequence. It's not uniform, but it appears to be uniform. And more precisely, if you have an attack, suppose you have a forgery algorithm with some chance of success, say it's totally reliable, always succeeds, or some limited chance of success, and say it runs at some speed, then you get a distinguisher, or something that's like a distinguisher subject to the restrictions on how successful it is, how long it takes, implies a comparably successful distinguisher. By a very straightforward conversion, here is how you take a forgery algorithm, for instance, the very slow one I wrote down here, and convert it into a something that would be a distinguisher if it's fast enough and successful enough. What you do is, here's how the distinguisher works. It simulates the entire network protocol, including the generation of messages and the production of authenticators. The distinguisher, all right, what does a distinguisher have as input? It has a big long string, 512 million bits, given, say, X, which is either a SALSA 20 output or a uniform random string, and we're trying to figure out which one it is. Here's what the distinguisher does. The distinguisher generates messages by whatever the message generation algorithm is. It authenticates the messages using this X, using viewing X as R, S1, S2, and so on. Authenticates messages using X. It feeds those authenticated messages to the forgery algorithm. So what I'm claiming here is that if you have a forgery algorithm like the one I just wrote down, then here is a distinguisher. Run the forgery algorithm. And then say yes if the forgery succeeded. And you can check if the forgery succeeds. because the distinguisher has the X, which is used as RS1, S2, and so on, say yes, print 1, if the forgery succeeds. And again, this is a general purpose substitution. Whatever types of attacks you're considering, not just forgeries, say multiple forgeries, multiple eavesdropping attacks, and so on, you can just apply the same substitution to your protocol, feed in X as the secret used by the sender and receiver, and then go through the attack, and if the attack succeeds, then say, yes, we had salsa 20. And if it doesn't succeed, then say, no, we didn't have salsa 20. At least that's your guess. Now what happens if X, what are the probabilities here of this distinguisher working? If X is a uniform random string, then we know that this is going to have a very small chance of saying yes. If X is a uniform random string, and we generate messages and authenticate them and run a forgery algorithm, which of course doesn't get to see X, and then say yes if the forgery succeeds, we've proven that that probability is very, very small, 1/2 to the 100 something. If, on the other hand, X is salsa 20 output, then a forgery algorithm against salsa 20 would succeed here with some noticeable probability. So the probability difference, aside from that 2^-130, the probability difference for the distinguisher is the probability of the forgery working. So if you have a forgery algorithm that works, then you get a distinguisher that works. And similarly, again, for every use of the salsa 20 output, any stream cipher output, in whatever protocol, you don't have to make separate conjectures, separate analyses of those protocols. If you have a security proof for your protocol, like Pauli 1305, then you can stop thinking about the details of that protocol and just conjecture that the salsa 20 output, your stream cipher output, is indistinguishable from uniform. And that's a security property that we look at in trying to attack this conjecture, and same conjecture for other stream ciphers. Nobody has to worry about any interaction between the distinguishers, between salsa 20 output and Pauli 1305. We know Pauli 1305 is secure. We conjecture salsa 20 is indistinguishable, and therefore we conclude that salsa 20 plus Pauli 1305 is secure without having to worry about interactions by this argument, which can be turned into a formal proof if you like. All right, let me summarize what we get for channel conversions thanks to the stream cipher, then say speed, and then I'm out of time for the morning. We have the sender sending, instead of R and a bunch of S's and maybe a bunch of T's, we have just 32 bytes, 256 bits of K sent through a secret authentic old channel. And we get out of it the best new channel. What we hope for from any protocol is the new channel, which handles any number of messages, provides, let's say we do the one-time pad along with Pauli 1305, then we get secrecy and authenticity, although only conjecturally. In my channel conversion pictures, I make sure to include the conjecture when we can't prove things. We have a conjecturally secret authenticated channel from the sender to the receiver of any number of messages, M1, M2, ... And this is, let's say, 16 LN bytes, N being the number of different S's, and L being the, maybe I should be a little careful, okay, it's slightly different N, off by some constant factor, but something like this number of bytes, theta of LN, a huge number of bytes, some small constant times L is the length of each message, N is the number of messages, and then times something like 16, I guess it's even more than 16 LN bytes at most. Huge channel, conjecturally secure in every way we might want, so aside from the question mark for the conjecture, wonderful new channel. The old channel is much smaller than anything we had before. Instead of having to transmit a lot of R's and S's and T's, we now have, well, one R and a lot of S's and a whole bunch of T's, we now have just a 32-byte key K. So this is obviously a better channel conversion. Assuming the conjecture is true, we have a better channel conversion than anything before. All right, how fast is this? Well, there is some cost. to salsa 20. I realized before I jump into the speed, I should pause. Are the security conjectures clear? Is it clear what stream ciphers are doing for us functionally in terms of security? At least conjecturally, I see some knots. Good. So, salsa 20 speed. Okay, what do I have to say about that? I have lots and lots of numbers. Let me tell you these numbers. In general, these are not as small as the Pauli 1305 numbers, although they scale differently. So, okay, let me just tell you the numbers and then say how to interpret them. What these numbers are going to be is cycles per output byte. Salsa 20 is producing a ton and ton of output, and of course you don't write down all the output if you only need some small part of it. So, depending on how many bytes you produce, depending on n, you have that many cycles per output byte from salsa 20. And the CPUs on my list, these are sorted by decreasing number of cycles per output byte. Our teaching tool is not particularly fast for this, 14.67. Ooh, gigantic number of cycles per output byte. Pentium 4, there's actually several different flavors of Pentium 4s with different performance, so to be thorough, I'll specify this is version F4.1 of the Pentium 4. That's a little bit faster, 14.11 cycles per output byte. Pentium M, my laptop, version 695, takes 12 cycles per output byte. And yeah, okay, flight machine variability. The Athlon we expect to be faster. Athlon 1, version 622, takes 10.73 cycles per byte. The PowerPC G5, the 970, the latest non-Intel Macintoshes, and also popular video game processor. The video games are switching over to the Cell, but, well, the G5 has certainly been used in Macintoshes, and that is actually makes Salsa 20 pretty happy, 7.9 cycles. And the last one on my list, there's some processors where things are slower, like the original Pentium. One processor where things are faster, and this is kind of embarrassing. I never actually expected that any processor would achieve this kind of speed. The G4, which wasn't so good for floating point arithmetic, there's probably better ways to do arithmetic on it. It happens accidentally to be very, very good for Salsa 20, taking 4.36 cycles per byte, per output byte. That's an exception. The typical performance is like this 10 or 12 or 14 cycles per byte. Salsa 20, as we're going to see, has a lot of rounds. Salsa 20 has 20 rounds. During each of those rounds, it does some computation, all the rounds being identical. And that iteration is something where if you think Salsa 20 is overkill, for reasons that I'll talk about, then you can just throw away some rounds and speed it up, producing, for example, Salsa 20/8. 8 rounds of Salsa 20, which I just have a few CPUs here on the UltraSpark 3, takes 6.77. It's approximately 8/20 of the 14.67. This is with some independent ECRIP timings with their timing tool overhead, so maybe it's not exactly 8/20. And there's also a little work in Salsa 20, just a tiny bit of work outside the round, so I would expect that to be a little more than 8/20 of 14.67, but you can do that calculation if you like. And similarly, all the other chips get sped up, like the Athlon, and my last example is the PowerPC, just for fun, the PowerPC G4 7410 takes 2.14 cycles per byte, and the Athlon is 5.01. And then there's many, many more stream ciphers out there. So the stream ciphers all have tables like this of how fast they are, many more stream ciphers. And in particular, I want to mention AES, which is the world's most popular stream cipher when it's run in counter mode. AES in counter mode. And the best thing I can say about it, I neglected to say, this is 128-bit AES in counter mode. If I scale AES down to just 128 bits of key, and then choose a Pentium 4 as the best case for AES, Pentium 4 cycles, then it's 15.69 cycles per byte, cycles per output byte, with a lot of variability depending on the machine. On an UltraSpark, AES is particularly bad. On a PowerPC, I guess it's also particularly bad. On an Athlon, it's, well, okay. Pentium 4 is the best case for AES. If I scale it down to 128 bits, then it's almost as fast as Delta 20, but not quite. And then there's lots of other stream ciphers. AES is part of the old generation. AES in counter mode, part of the old generation of stream ciphers, hampered by a block cipher structure. There's many more stream ciphers, which I will say more about this afternoon. Let me say more about the speed issues of SALSA 20. I still have 7 minutes. Question? Counter mode simply means that, well, AES, you take AES of 0, AES of 1, AES of 2, etc. With you have a key in AES, you take AES of k, 0, AES of k, 1, each of which is 128 bits, and then you concatenate those 128-bit strings. Now, AES, what I'm about to say about SALSA 20 also applies to AES, and understanding AES in counter mode is very much like understanding SALSA 20 with its random access feature. So let me come back to AES in a moment and say, yeah, so extra speed feature of many stream ciphers, including SALSA 20, including any block cipher in counter mode, is that with only a slight speed penalty, which I'll talk about in a moment, you have fast random access to the output. The way that SALSA 20 is computed, as we'll see in the definition this afternoon, is that SALSA 20 of K is computed as the concatenation of a 512-bit SALSA 20 of K, 0, a 512-bit SALSA 20 of K, 1, etc., all of those concatenated. Each of those can be computed quickly, and the time for that is just, well, take the time for the cycles per output byte and multiply by 512 bits, multiply by 64 bytes. So take these numbers times 64, and that tells you how long it takes to do random access to the SALSA 20 output. I have this feeling that I wanted some other comment about this. Okay, to emphasize the use of this, the reason that random access is a very useful speed feature of a stream cipher is that you compute these outputs on demand. Whenever you need an output, you compute it. Whenever you need an R or S1 or something, you figure it out by evaluating SALSA 20 at that appropriate input, and you don't ever store them. Instead has an A in it, S-T-E-A-D. Okay, instead of storing the outputs like RS1 and so on, you compute the outputs when you need them, bouncing around if necessary. Somebody gives you an N, you can figure out S sub N very quickly. And this means that you don't need storage, you don't need space for the outputs RS1, S2, etc. You minimize the memory access costs for your different keys. If you have many users you're talking to, even one user with a lot of S's, you can run into cache misses just accessing different S's in this stream. And you completely avoid that by having a randomly accessible stream cipher like SALSA 20, or coming back to AES. AES looks very much the same, but 128-bit outputs that get concatenated, 128-bit key K. AES also doesn't have as strong a security conjecture, to be precise. AES is supposed to be, the AES outputs are supposed to be indistinguishable from distinct 128-bit outputs, which is not exactly what we need for, say, Poly 1305 or any other secret key protocol. AES doesn't give us, once you start looking at a lot of outputs, like, say, 2 to the 50 outputs, you start noticing distinctions between the AES output and a uniform random string. Plus, AES only has a 128-bit key with the speed levels that people like to use. Plus, AES is slow. Well, there's lots of reasons to use the latest generation of stream ciphers, but structurally, AES has the same feature of any block cipher has a concatenation of outputs that gives you the stream output. Let me pause at this point. Did I answer your question about the converting a block cipher into a stream cipher? Okay. I want to specify the computing outputs on demand, and then it looks like that'll be it for the morning. Maybe I could say a little bit more, but time to raise UMAC and move to what exactly do you do if you're given a message that you want to authenticate. Well, you can go through SALSA 20 outputs in order from the sender side, but on the receiver side, you might get your packets out of order, especially if an attacker is feeding you packets out of order. If you're given a nonce, a message number, the N that I was saying before, you simply feed it to the SALSA 20 computation. You compute the 512-bit SALSA 20 of K, N. And what do we need out of this? Well, you use 128 bits as estimate. You use 128 bits as estimate. Or S of N, I think, was one of my previous notations. S of N is the first 128 bits of SALSA 20, KN. And you might say, wait a minute, we're throwing away 384 bits. This is actually not as fast as it could be. It certainly seems wasteful to discard 384 bits. How much time are we taking for the SALSA 20 computation? Well, again, multiply the previous numbers by 64 for 64 bytes. It's, say, less than 300 cycles on a G4, but more than 900 cycles on a Pentium 4. For computing SALSA 20 on one input. If you have, let's say, a 1024-byte packet that you're authenticating, then you might spend, say, 6,000 cycles for 1024-byte Poly 1305. What we're doing with the S sub N is using it to authenticate a long message, and one fairly short S sub N authenticates a fairly long message. Let's say 1,500 bytes is your typical big internet packet size if you're transmitting a lot of data. If you have shorter packets, then it becomes more important. But, okay, there's some noticeable plus here for the time for SALSA 20 is more than you might hope for, but it's negligible compared to having a long packet that we're authenticating. This afternoon, I'm going to start with situations where this is more of a speed constraint. I want to finish off now by saying how you can make better use of the 512 bits, if you like. Remember, Wegman and Carter suggested reusing R in 1979, they said, hey, we've got a long R, and it's important to reuse it. They reused R, and their whole point was to try to minimize the amount of secret data you need, to minimize the secret length. If there were a different R for every message, which is maybe the more straightforward way to handle authenticating lots of messages, each N gives you an RN and an SN, then the length of your secret is you have to multiply the length of the R by the number of messages. Instead of just having a separate S for every message, you have a fairly long R for Wegman and Carter times the number of messages. But this argument that you want to minimize the length of the secret, the only reason that we're doing that is to save time for generating secrets. And in this case, we're generating 512 bits anyway. So you might as well use another 128 bits for your R. Instead of having an R, F sub n, have an R sub n, F sub n. And this has no extra cost, since we're generating 512 bits anyway. It's only 256 bits. Since each R is fitting along with S inside 512 bits, if you're using SALSA 20 to generate your outputs, which, again, is a small cost compared to message authentication, then you might as well go ahead and generate R separately for each message, too. And this is something I didn't have in my head a week ago. The reason for wanting to do this, it's not just that it has no cost, but it actually has a benefit, which Tanya pointed out by a question last week. The advantage of doing this is, remember the issue of forging messages again and again. If some attacker guesses R and then confirms the guess by successfully forging a message, now I've been saying, okay, that doesn't happen. But if you try to scale your security down, or if you just worry, okay, what if we get really unlucky and it does happen, and the attacker sees that his R is correct, then he can use that to forge more and more messages, because R is reused for all the different ends. But if we have a separate R for each message number, then that's trivial to stop. If you have a separate R sub n and S sub n, then the attacker who guesses R sub n without guessing any other R's can only forge one message. And as soon as he's done that, I'm assuming here standard part of how internet protocols work, which is that when the receiver has successfully used a message number, then it doesn't accept any more messages with that number. Assuming that the receiver does the trivial state management required for, say, TCP, any other internet protocol that keeps track of which messages are which has to enforce a message not being replayed and sent and given to the receiver's application again, assuming the receiver increments n and then doesn't accept any more messages with that n. Typically, receivers will have a little window of n's they'll accept, and they keep track for each n. In case the packets show up out of order, then they'll accept the subsequent n and then not accept it any further. And then once they've gotten a previous n, then they'll move forward in the n. Point is, any particular n, the receiver accepts only one message under that n, and that makes R sub n useless for further forgeries. All the issues I was saying about reforging a message rely on the attacker guesses R sub n. If he's successful, deduces that his guess was correct by seeing the receiver accept the message, and then uses the R for more messages. But if R is depending on the message, then that's not possible anymore. Okay, I have more to say about the speed of SALSA 20 in the context of encryption, when we care much more about the speed of it, and then denial of service issues, and finally give the definition of SALSA 20, but I'm over time for the morning. Were there any last quick questions about SALSA 20? Yeah. That's absolutely right. So there is more space. You could have a somewhat longer R. And there's different scales of how long the R are. In this context, let's say 512 bits is our limit. We're doing one SALSA 20 computation and then authenticating a long message. You could have, for this length of message, say 1024 bytes or up to 1500 bytes, you might need for UMAC something like that length. I guess for each chunk of the message, there is a chunk of the R in UMAC, up to some limit. At some point, they start using a different structure to have the R not expanding without bound. But for 1024-byte messages, UMAC needs a 1024-byte R. And that doesn't fit. That's much larger than the 64 bytes produced by SALSA 20. But there's intermediate possibilities. Wegman-Carter reduces the number of R's down to something logarithmic, which still is not quite, I guess we could have three separate R's in this case, along with an S, all generated at the same time for free out of 512 bits of salsa 20. The 512 is kind of dictated by the security level salsa 20 is going for, as I'll talk about later today. Given that 512, we could generate three R's and one S, and then you could imagine polynomial evaluation in three variables. And the question now is, can you, from a message, can you encode a message as a three-variable polynomial, guaranteeing that it's an encoding, it's injective, every message gives you a different polynomial in those three variables, in such a way that you're not using, say, L multiplications, where L is the length of your message. And you can certainly do things like, this is what I was saying, it's an open question last time. For short messages, it's easy to do. I just don't know the answer for longer messages, but for, maybe I'll just fill in here, you could do something like, say you have one R and another R prime. Right, let me just call them X and Y to emphasize they're different variables. If you write down M1 plus X times M2 plus Y, and then I think the version I checked, I subtracted off XY, which is, all right, there's three numbers, maybe you could subtract off a Z instead, and then take this and add M3 to it and add an X to it and multiply by M4 plus Y, and then subtract XY again for consistent inner loops. This for M1, M2, M3, M4, I believe, if I calculated correctly, this determines M1, M2, M3, and M4 if they're all not equal to 0 and not equal to minus 1. Some of them have to be non-zero, some of them have to be not minus 1. And looking at the number of multiplications here, XY and XY, say XY is Z instead, then there's one multiplication there and one multiplication there. So two multiplications handling four message chunks. But I don't know whether this scales. I don't know how to prove things when I start getting to longer and longer messages. It certainly is something like the Winograd idea. And there's much more if you look in section 6.4 of Knuth's Art of Computer Programming. Find all sorts of references to literature on preconditioned polynomial evaluation. And there's some tricky geometric questions that show up there. And I just don't know how to translate those into a working cryptographic protocol, but I feel like, yes, this is the direction to go. If you have, say, two R's or three R's, can you somehow convert a message of 1024 bytes, and here I've handled only 64 bytes, can you handle a 1024 byte message and encode it with a small number of multiplications? Here we've got only two multiplications instead of the four that you might expect. Can you, with a small number of multiplications, figure out a polynomial which is different for your different messages? I didn't actually check for this one. Got to be careful about the addition of S. But something like this works with two multiplications for four message chunks. And you could reasonably try to put everything together, have, say, three R's. To answer your question, UMAC has way too many R's to fit inside 64 bytes. It has something like 1024 bytes for a 1024 byte message. But you can reasonably try to take advantage of the UMAC type, the Winograd dot product trick, and somehow handle a small number of variables, a relatively long message, and save time in your message authentication by reducing the number of field operations. I think this is the research direction in this area, to the extent that it's not completely mined yet. This is the direction to go. Okay, were there any last questions about the stuff so far? If not, then sorry for running over time. I will see everybody at 3:30.